Okay, welcome to the First Circle of Respect Book Club series. I'm here with Roslyn Wiseman. Hi, Roslyn.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No problem. First, I just want to start off and give you a chance to discuss your new book, Queen Bees and Wannabes. I know that you had come out with a book before and it was a great success, and we really wanted to know what made you want to revisit the topic and reissue the book.
Sure. About 2 years ago, I started feeling guilty that parents were buying Queen Bees and Wannabes because things had changed so much for girls and for boys with technology. And also, I wanted to know if people, I wanted to answer the question that people were asking me, which was, is it starting earlier? Are girls getting meaner younger? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to answer that question as well. So, and I needed to revisit all of the different things that I had written in Queen Bees and Wannabes and set, and really, you know, was it still relevant? What was, what wasn't, what had changed? And I really knew that technology had changed it. I had no idea how much I would rewrite the book when I first started, and I end up rewriting about 70% of the book because things have changed that significantly.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, just sort of going back a little bit, the teen world is something that really baffles and scares a lot of parents out there. What's something, what made you want to get involved in that work and working with teens when it's something that's so scary?
Sure. Well, actually, I fell into it like most people when they, if you fall into something and you actually persevere, and it's been a really incredible experience because I really, for whatever reason, like working with teenagers. I mean, I like kids who argue with me and challenge me and are really obnoxious. And I don't know, like sort of the more obnoxious and the more in my face, the better. I don't know why, but it is, it's true. I love to debate. And I also think that teens ask excellent questions. And it's, I feel like this is my calling about working with teenagers and being able to be in their world and be able to help them with the things that they're going through, because I think what they're going through is really important. And at the same time, be able to pierce basically the bubble. You know, when kids, for example, are getting teased every day or being hazed every day, that's normal to them. That is their common experience. And so it feels like if it's normal, then why should I change it? You know, I mean, maybe I hate it, but there's nothing I can do. But I feel like my role and a lot of adults' role is to pierce that bubble and say, well, actually, that's, yes, it might be common, but it doesn't make it right. I mean, people have been mean and horrible to each other forever, but that doesn't make it right. And so we are going to figure out a way for you to have some control over this situation so that you can develop competency and handle these things better. Because at some point, you got to figure it out. At some point, you have to be able to take bad things that happen to you, or you see somebody else getting treated badly or cruelly, and you have to be able to say something, or else you are not in control of yourself. The other people are. And most teenagers want to be in control of themselves. Most people want to be in control of themselves.
Okay. Sort of piggybacking off of teenagers need to empower themselves and be in control. What have you seen has been the impact of technology? We all see YouTube videos and social sites. How do you think that's impacted the clicks and things that you discuss in your book?
Well, I think one of the mistakes that we make in education is that we want to teach kids about cyberbullying as if it exists apart from the rest of the world, right? There's bullying and then there's cyberbullying. These things are absolutely intertwined. Technology is intertwined into every aspect of our lives, and so there should be no surprise that technology, because it is intertwined, that the ways in which kids use it for good and bad are intertwined. So it is understandable that kids will say, well, of course we're mean to each other, like, on technology, because, you know, people are mean in real life, they're mean on, you know, in whatever e-life we have. So I think that's really important for parents to realize. I think the issue that parents need, there's so many things that parents need to realize about this technology stuff. One is that they can get a handle on it without being experts. And that if their child programs their cell phone does not mean they can never discipline about technology, right? Because most parents will say, like, well, my kid is completely in control of all of this stuff, and I can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I don't want to take my kid's cell phone away because I won't be able to reach them when I want them to. It is absolutely imperative that if you are a parent and you are listening to this and you want to raise children with good values, meaning they treat people ethically, they are kind, they have integrity, they don't lie, they don't want to humiliate people, they think that humiliating people is wrong, just at base, that they think that's wrong, that not everything is funny, that humiliating people is not funny. If you want your children to understand that as a family value, you must tie your family values to technology, because that is where they are going to be seeing people humiliating each other. And it is where they're going to be seeing people treating each other cruelly. So to give the child the cell phone or whatever it is and not say, if you abuse it and I find out about it, and I will find out about it because I'm going to go and like periodically check what's going on, what you're doing online. And in fact, I don't even need to use your cell phone to figure that out because I'm just going to go on my service provider's website and I can go on my account and look at what you're sending and receiving. So if I find out that you're doing that, you are going to have this taken away and you're not going to get it back until you earn the right to get it back. If we don't do that, really, honestly, you have missed one of the biggest opportunities as a parent to be a parent in your child's life.
Good point. So what do you say to parents who may get discouraged when they're talking to their children about tough issues and any issues that might come up with social networking sites and all of the bullying that may happen on those sites? What do you say to them who might get discouraged when they feel like they're conflicting with the messages that they're getting through media, what the messages they're trying to teach their kids are conflicting with media messages and the messages their kids are getting from their friends and other social sites? What do you say to them to keep them from getting discouraged?
Well, I think actually you need to pull it back a little bit. I mean, one of the things I do in Queen Bees a lot is I ask parents to check their own baggage, to look in the mirror a lot, which is not pleasant as a parent, but we have to do it. And one of the things that I think is really important is how, you know, we as adults talk about how connected or addicted to connection kids are. They're constantly texting, they're constantly whatever, they're constantly interacting with technology, but so are we. I mean, one of the things that I ask kids a lot in this, in, for this version of Queen Bees and Wannabes was, you know, okay, your parents are telling me that you're getting like 3,000 texts a month. Like, who are you texting? And one of the biggest responses, most common responses I got from the kids was their parents. They would say, well, yeah, I text, but my parents text me like 15 times a day. So, I mean, I had children who showed me their cell phones, and I had two kids show me, and it was noon. It was just like spontaneous thing we were talking about. And they, between 7 in the morning and 12 at noon, one of them had received 11 text messages from their parents. The other had received like 16. And it was everything from like, hi, I'm on the highway driving to, you know, pick up grandma, to the twins are sleeping in the back, to now I'm at the house. So honestly, if you're a parent and you're all worried about your child being addicted to connection, you got to look at yourself first and you got to control the impulse to be constantly giving every detail of your life to your child. Now, I want parents to be connected to their children. The problem is that if you have so much connection, your kids actually tune you out. And they're actually not going to pay attention to the email or the text where you actually need to convey information. They're just going to be like, oh yeah, there's my mom again, right? And just go, whatever. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, with media, is that, again, parents have to really look at their own, whether they are buying into it. So, for example, when you're, if your child, if you have an 8-year-old, 9-year-old daughter, and she is really into hip-hop class, because that's what your neighborhood community is, you know, offering, your daughter's, like, really, really into it, and she can mimic all the songs so perfectly, to all the songs, are you posting those on web, on YouTube because you think they're so cute, or, like, her dancing around? Like, can she do Single Ladies, and you think that's really adorable, so you put that on YouTube? Because I love Single Ladies, I love Beyonce, but 8-year-olds, it's not, it's cute, but it's also sexualizing 8-year-olds, right? And so, and then if you go on, you know, back to the hip-hop stuff, you know, hip-hop dance recitals that are now so popular, is that there's not a lot of thought about what people are buying for the costumes for those things. So it's, so it is sexualizing girls at very early ages, and to make them actually teens before they've even reached their tween years. So really, before you start looking at other people, you got to look at yourself and your buying habits and what you're buying into. And then, of course, oh, the last part, I mean, I could go on forever on this one. I mean, there are parents who believe really strongly that they shouldn't let their kids watch PG-13 movies, who have tween kids. Okay, totally, 100% agree with that. You have your, of course, you have your right to decide which ones and, you know, make it appropriate or not. But those same parents are letting their kids have their cell phones at their bed at night when they go to sleep. So the only bubble that exists in this parent's mind of, like, her home being safe and creating a safe space is in her mind or in his mind. Because once you have a cell phone by a kid's bed, the entire world goes in and out of that, out of the bedroom. So parents are hyper-focused on PG-13 movies, like their kid actually going to a movie and not realizing their kid can see whatever they want on Hulu. So it's really important to actually take a step back and educate yourself so you understand the things you're doing that might be just you haven't figured it out yet that actually contribute to this. And then the other part is, and then what was the other question you asked me, sort of part B question that you asked me about, like, the media, if it's in conflict?
Yeah, just sort of how do you... if when they feel that they're getting so many competing messages from media,
right,
how
right.
do they then reinforce
sure,
what they're trying
sure,
to say
sure.
at home?
Okay, so after, you know, the process of self-reflection, I think that, you know, when there's, I think there's a lot to be said for compromise about, okay, so if your 10-year-old loves, we're just going to, like, use single ladies as the example right now, because it's, like, right, because it's gotten to, because it's, you know, sort of old, but at the same time, in the most of the country, it's, like, love it.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll use that. And okay, so if you, if your daughter loves that, and there's nothing wrong, there's no bad words in that song, there's no highly sexualized, there's nothing, you know, that's actually a good example, because on the face of it, you would look at that and be like, well, it's an amazing dance routine, Beyonce is amazing, she's totally self-respecting, it's great. I think what you have to do is to look to compromise. So if your daughter, for example, is really into fashion, and she really loves, you know, a particular pair of jeans or leggings that you think are ridiculously tight, then I think you compromise and you don't, you do a couple of things. You give her a budget, she doesn't go over it. You, you don't give her more money, right? You have ultimate veto power. If, I think there's just common sense things that you always say as a parent where she complains and whines about, like, I hate you so much, you know, like, I think I even had that this morning with my own children. I hate you so much, you're so unfair, every kid has one but me. That's what I had yesterday, I thought it was so funny. Was you say, you know what, I'm really sorry, but you should have chosen a different parent. When you came into this world, you made the mistake of choosing me. That's what you get. So that is unfortunate for you, you made a poor choice, but this is what you've got. And I laugh about that with my own kids. But the other part is, last night, I had one of my, a 9-year-old said to me, I want a cell phone. And actually the first time he's ever asked me about that. And I laughed because I had spent most of the day talking to parents and educators about this exact issue. So I turned to the parent next to me and I said, does your child have a cell phone? And he said, no. I'm like, look, not everybody has a cell phone. And I think also if kids say, like, every kid has one but me, this is what I think you should do. Although 75% of teens now have cell phones, apparently, according to Pew Research. But I think that you should do it as a research project. Like, so your child has to, I'm serious, calls up every parent in their grade and say, does your child have a cell phone? And yes or no. They can do it as a person. They can learn math. They can do percentages. It'll be awesome. They report, they do a business report back to you. 14% this, 12% that, you know, give you a business report. And then, obviously, ultimately, you have the veto power to say, well, thank you very much for that report. You've done an excellent job. And right now, you are not going to get a cell phone, but I'm liking where you're going with this. And so 6 months from now, we're going to revisit it. But you need to show me before you get that kind of stuff. You absolutely have to show me that you can handle the power of it. I mean, at the same time, the last thing I would say about this is, the other part is, I'm also talking about a personal cell phone, right, versus a cell phone that a family has that they could give to a child. So if your child's going to a concert or anything where they could get lost easily, sure, I would say give them a cell phone, right, for that moment, right? But if you have a 12-year-old child going to a concert and you give them their cell phone, you have to know that, okay, yes, they're going to use it when they get lost, but they are also going to use it to do lots of things with it as well with all their friends, and many of them are not going to be the best. It's not going to be, you're not going to look at these texts for the most part and be very proud of what they're saying.
Okay. I just want to switch gears a little bit. We've been talking a lot about daughters and girls, but just to talk a little bit about the boys.
Sure.
In your book, you talked about this boy code and they sort of exist in internal conflict with traditional codes of ethics that we talk about. How do you propose that boys themselves mediate this conflict when they feel they have to choose and they're not really sure, you know, which one is right? Do I have to choose?
That's hard.
Mm-hmm. And also, what did you say to parents who are sort of contributing to that conflict? Because
sure.
I know in a lot of the experiences that we have at NCPC, some parents might say, well, bullying is, you know, it's a way of life. That's just something, it's a rite of passage.
Sure,
she'll
sure.
get over it, that
sure.
type of thing. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, there's so much about that. First of all, the whole girls will be girls and boys will be boys thing is so old, mm-hmm. frankly, because, or say it to you this way, yes, people have been mean to each other forever. Boys can be mean to each other, girls can be mean to each other. Being mean, just because it's common doesn't make it right. So the thing that adults do is they look at things and go, well, we've always done it like that, so it's not that big a deal. The other part is that just because boys play with trucks does not mean that they have no feelings. So, and that they're not going to get hurt when somebody's mean to them. And I think one of the things that's really another thing that people say a lot, especially to me as a mother of two sons, is they say, you know, boys are so hard when they're little, but they're so much easier when they're older, and girls are so easy when they're little, and they're so much they're so hard when they're older. You are so lucky to have two sons. I have to tell you, as somebody who works a lot with boys and girls, and I've always worked with boys equally as girls, what I think boys do is they are very good at not complaining when things are happening to them that are really hurtful. And so one of the things that I think is really complicated and confusing for people working with boys, especially people who are not men, is that you can ask a boy, you know, are you okay? And he could have just stubbed his toe, and he would say, yeah, I'm fine. And, like, his dad could be hitting his mom, or his mom could be hitting him, or he could be having a pencil stabbed in his neck every time he goes, he gets on the bus, and he'll say, no, it's fine, don't worry about it. Right? And so it's really, boys are so conditioned not to complain, because if they complain, then their masculinity is going to be questioned. And so one of the things that I do, and I think, and this is definitely one of the things I rewrote in Queen Bees, was being able to give boys a language, an option, besides do nothing or physically step up to somebody. And that's really empowering to boys, and it's also very freeing to them, where they want to be men of honor. And there's a few boys, just like there are a few girls, who create a tremendous amount of conflict and pain in a group of kids. And there's a lot more kids, of course, who are bystanding to that and don't know what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And the problem, of course, with boys is that when they're in these moments of bystanding, they often feel like they often get tested by the bully, and who's going to say, if you aren't with me, you're against me, and I'm going to turn on you. And they don't even need to say that for the boys to feel it and internalize it and act upon it, which is why boys laugh a lot when they see something that's really horrible, because laughing is a way of getting yourself off the hook and saying, I don't have to do anything about this because I don't have to take it seriously. So one of the things that I tell teachers a lot, for example, walking down the hallway, is if you see a boy get, like, shoved up against the locker by another boy, one of the things that a lot of women will do is they will address the target. They will address their words to the target, like, are you okay? You know, and then they go to the perpetrator. The target has no choice in that moment but to say, I'm totally fine, right? Because he's going to deal with the perpetrator, not you. So women oftentimes will direct their attention to the target. That reinforces the power dynamic. It actually reinforces the power of the bully when you do that. So what I tell teachers a lot to do is to say, to address the perpetrator and say, what you are doing, and be very specific about it, that is not absolutely allowed in my hallway, in my classroom, in my school, whatever the pronoun. It's a pronoun, your pronoun, my, our, right? And then be specific about where it is. And then go later up to the target when he's away from everybody and say, hey, you know what? I'd be totally wrong about this. I might be totally out of my mind. You always have to phrase that when you say things like that with teenagers, because you have to say, I might be totally wrong. I might have read this completely incorrectly. But, you know, if I was getting shoved into the lockers every day, I would be pretty bummed about it. I wouldn't necessarily like it. If I was getting hit upside the head, if I was being stabbed by it with pencils, if I was being called gay or, like, in a derogatory way every single day, or retarded, which is, like, ubiquitous in schools now, I would be pretty bummed about it. And so you know that if you have a problem, you can come talk to me about that, right? And, or if it, you know, or did that bother you? And he has a choice to say, like, yes or no at that moment. But also for boys, you also need to, like, plant a little seed. I mean, this is true for girls too, but it's really, really relevant for boys. You plant a little seed and then you walk away and you say, you know what, I could be totally wrong, but I saw that. I'm piercing the reality, right? That's not cool. And if you're bothered by it, you can always come talk to me. And then if he says, fine, you know, no, it's cool, Ms. Wiseman, like sometimes they say, like, okay, that's cool, but, like, if it ever changes, then come back to me. So you're opening the door for a kid to come back to you. And I also think, just for parents who are listening to this, if somebody comes to you who's being bullied, I mean, your kid's being bullied, I really do not want you to say, just ignore it. I mean, I really, 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 really don't want you to do that, because for the most part, there is so much pressure on kids not to tell what's going on, that by the time they come and talk to an adult, they've been thinking, for the vast majority of children, they've been thinking about talking to for a very long time. And for you to say, just ignore it, is like, okay, I've just spent all this time and I'm so apprehensive, and I go up to this person, basically it's a blow off. And it looks like there's really nothing you can do, right? It's like, well, there's nothing you can do about it, so just ignore it. what we really are looking for is kids being able to have social competency and taking these difficult moments and being able to speak their words and have some control over really difficult situations. So we need to give kids the power to be and the skills to be able to do that. And the other, so I say to the kids when they come to me, three things. I say, I'm so sorry that this happened to you. Thank you for telling me, and together we're going to work on this. And a lot of kids will say to their parents, okay, I'm going to tell you this, but you have to promise not to do anything about it. And I would strongly suggest to parents that they do not make that promise. Because if you make that promise, you might have to break it. So what I would suggest you do instead is say, I would really love to make this promise, but I cannot. Because you might tell me something, I've got to go find somebody who knows more about this than I do. Right? Like, I'm not an expert on bullying. Right? Or even if my kids, and they have, come to me, I needed to get more help because they're my kids. And so when they're my kids, like, I totally stress out and get super anxious. I can't help them. Mm-hmm. Besides saying, I love you and we're going to work on it. So you can't make the promise of you won't go to somebody else, but you can say, but we're going to work on this, and I promise you that if we bring somebody in, you're never going to be surprised and blindsided by that person. You will always be brought into the process.
Sort of also switching a little bit, just telling, we talk a lot about what to tell parents to do. What do you think kids might find of value with your book? Because I know a lot of parents that we know have read some of those chapters with their kids with them, and so I want to know what you think kids would find of value.
Well, you know, I wrote Queen Bees and Wannabes with the assumption that no child would ever read it. Because, like, why would any child read a book about, right? I was like, why would anybody want to read that? And I was so wrong about that. Kids read it all the time. Boys and girls read it. And so this time around, I thought about that as I was writing it. And there was a couple of times in the book where I basically addressed the child himself or herself. Like, hey, pull your parent, like, put your parent aside and read what I'm saying to you, right? And, like, engage with me in this process. And one of the things that I say to kids a lot is, you know, you might think that going to an adult is, like, the worst idea ever with these kinds of problems. But, and I grant kids that sometimes there are some adults who make situations in bullying worse because they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. They call up a parent, start screaming, they make the problem bigger. And I think what's important for kids to realize is the way I say it, is I say, look, not all adults are clueless and useless. Not all. I will grant you some are, but not all. And so your job, however old you are, is to be able to identify who the people are in your life who are not clueless and are not useless. People that are not going to fight your fights for you. They're not going to get you out of things, right? But they're going to sit with you and try and figure out the next best steps. And they're going to help you. They're going to push you to do things you don't want to do. And they are going, but they're going to be behind you every step of the way telling you you can do it. Those are people called allies that I think you have, if at all possible, that's a kid needs to be able to find those people. Those are the people that really, no matter what kind of horrible situation you're in, kids can be in horrible situations. And if they're able to identify somebody like that, it is the path out. So it's, I think it's, and it's also for parents, it's not, you're not a bad parent if your child needs this, right? You're actually just a parent. Mm-hmm. A lot of parents feel like they're not being as good as they need to in the parenting department if their kid needs somebody else. And that's just absolutely so not the case. So I say that, so that's important for kids to know. I think for kids also what I say to them is, like, if you are being really bullied, I think it's really important that to whatever extent, at the very least, you identify what is it that you hate. Besides these people are being miserable and horrible, that you say, what is it exactly I hate, even though it might be obvious, right? Like, it is obvious that somebody saying that you should die and they hate you and putting it on a YouTube channel is terrible, and that's horrible. But you actually need to state it out loud for yourself. And then there's a process I want you to go through where you say, you know, you think about these bad feelings, you put them to words, you think about when and where you need to speak to this person publicly and privately. You say exactly what you don't like, you say exactly what you want. You affirm your right to walk down the hallway in peace, not being treated with dirt, like dirt. You take responsibility for the things that you might have done that contributed to the problem, because especially with technology, lots of this stuff is very fluid. Right? I mean, people are doing things, right? It's not always, you know, one thing or one way. But, and that no matter what you do some part of that, right? You don't have to do it all on one day. You can just start with, like, it's the SEAL strategy that I use in all of my books, where you just do the ask, which is stop. You don't have to do the explain and the affirm and the acknowledge. Like, you just, every step of this you do, you get to a place where you can say uncomfortable feelings and do them in a way where you're treating yourself seriously and you're treating the other person seriously. I think that's important for kids to realize. And then the last part is that, well, there's two things. One is you don't go into this expecting the bully's going to say, oh my gosh, you're so right. I'm so horrible that I, like, took your password and, you know, sent everybody a cut, you know, picture of you, like a pasted picture that looks like you to your entire email list and everybody's now talking about it. I think you're not going to get what you want, which is if what you want is you are best friends afterwards, you've completely destroyed the other person. I'm trying to think about it and convincing kids to think about it in a way of that's not the goal. The goal is to be able to look the person in the eye to some extent and to voice your truth. You just can't go into it expecting the person's going to say, oh my gosh, you're so right. In fact, of course they're going to say something obnoxious at the very least, because they have to, because you're taking away their power. So they have to roll their eyes and say something horrible. They have to. Mm-hmm. They're doing exactly what is expected of them. Say it that way. The last part I would say for kids who are being bullied is that it is extraordinarily important when you are speaking to the bully to say, okay, yes, you're making my life miserable, and I totally own it. Like, it's not a sign of weakness to own that you're hurt. It's not. To be able to stand there in front of somebody and say, yeah, you know what? It is horrible. I hate it. You have accomplished your goal. If your goal was to make me miserable and dread going to school, you have been successful. Good job, right? But I'm still strong enough to be able to talk to you about this. I'm still strong enough to be able to actually have this conversation with you. So you can do what you want. You can continue to do this to me. You can continue making me miserable. But at the very least, I'm choosing my misery, which is that at the very least, I have some control over this situation, which is I am strong enough to be able to say to you, and this is where I'm at. You got it, right? But I'm stronger for that in any case. And I think that's really important for kids who are being bullied, because it feels like you just have absolutely no power and the person is controlling your life. Especially with technology, it feels like the person is controlling your life. You got to take some of the control back.
Okay. Before we wrap up, we understand that you have a new book coming out in January, I believe.
Yes, I do.
Boys, Girls, and Other Hazardous Materials.
Excellent. Good job.
Uh-huh. I love
the
title.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I wanted to ask you, what made you decide to sort of go at it from a novel and go from nonfiction to fiction,
right?
And how are you able to tackle some of the same issues and reach teens in that way?
Well, the reason I wrote it was because somebody asked me to. I mean, and for better and for worse, I have this attitude in life of how hard could it be, whatever it is, having no idea. And sometimes that's a really good thing and sometimes it's a really bad thing. So I was asked to write this novel by Penguin Publishers, and they said to me, like, well, you have stories about kids. You can put it together in some kind of novel form. And I said, okay, sure. Well, it was the hardest thing by far. It's the hardest thing that I've ever written. I had no idea how to write fiction when I first started. I hope I have some degree of knowing how to write fiction now. But I didn't want it to be preachy, obviously, and I wanted it to be funny, and I wanted it to be something. I didn't want it to be like some rich kids in some apartment in New York. That would have been so easy. That's so easy to write. It takes like 10 seconds to write that. It's not hard. I wanted to be able to reflect what I saw of my students' experiences around the country. I wanted to be able to depict or have a situation, like, because so many schools now look like malls. Like, there have been so many kids who now go to school in schools that look like malls. And I wanted that to be reflected. I just am not seeing a lot of books that reflect what I think are the usual teen experience. And that those things are, and just because, and again, because it's usual does not make it extraordinary in some ways, that you have to deal with extraordinarily difficult situations. And I wanted a girl character who really was friends with boys, and it was not so stereotypical, right, that everything wasn't so stereotypical, and that she was in situations that were difficult, and she didn't do a good job of it. You know, she caved on several occasions when she was supposed to do the right thing, she doesn't. And I wanted to talk about, like, what race looks like and how kids of different races are dealing with white kids in schools. And because I think, for example, that, like, East Asian kids from India, Pakistan, pretty much anybody, most kids that are not white are going to have more in common with their family values. Like, their parents are going to be more strict, way more strict than white parents. And there's a lot of pretty funny but pretty ridiculous conversations that go on between white kids and their friends who aren't white about how lenient their white parents are. And I really wanted to talk about that. I wanted the kids to talk about that with each other because I've listened to those conversations and they are incredibly funny. And they're also incredibly revelatory about what parent culture is like. So, and the difference, you know, and these kids are together in these enormous schools, and then they go back into their worlds, and they go back into their enormous schools. So, what was that like? And also, what was happening with girls and boys and hazing and being a part of these very large schools? So that was what I decided the book was going to be about. It is by far the thing I'm the most nervous of anything I've ever written. I've never, ever been this nervous. I don't think I've ever been nervous about a book. I've been excited about a book coming out. But I don't think I've ever been nervous about a book coming out. I am borderline terrified of what young people are going to think because, you know, like, are they going to like it? Is it going to be something they can relate to? Like, will they? I tried my best, but maybe I didn't get it. And I tried really hard. So it's going to be, I wrote 600 pages and the book is like 250 pages long. So it's going to be pretty painful if they don't like it. So I'm hopeful that they will, and in all seriousness, I really respect what kids are going through in the country, and I wanted to reflect that in as accurately as possible. So it's important to me that I got it, and I hope I did.
Well, I'm excited to read it. I read Queen Bees and Wannabes, and you really do have a talent for tackling tough issues in a way that doesn't freak people out or make them feel completely
I don't know about that. I've actually freaked some people out plenty of times.
So I'm definitely excited to read that new book. Well, thank you, Rosalind, for speaking with us today.
My pleasure, absolutely.
For more information on Rosalind's book, Queen Bees and Wannabes, and for information on bullying and cyberbullying, you can visit www.circleofrespect.org. Thanks again, Rosalind.